Hi folks, hope all is well. This is Jim Carroll. Welcome you to the latest in our series of banter podcasts recorded at the Web Summit in Lisbon earlier this month. It's the first time we've had an Olympic medal winner at banter, and that was swimmer Alison Wagner, who won a silver medal for the United States at the 1996 Games in Atlanta behind Michelle Smith. Alison and former Canadian Olympic swimmer Nicky Dryden joined us for a dive into the deep, murkier end of the swim pool. We'll look at the current state of the anti-doping movement, and we asked why more attention is not being paid to systematic doping schemes in sport. Please excuse the background noise on this podcast. The banter stage at Web Summit was located in the main hall, and there was a bit of coming and going on behind us.
To banter here at Web Summit, the final Web Summit banter interview. My name is Jim Carroll. What we're doing here is basically we're doing, I suppose, long form interviews with interesting people we've come across at the Web Summit, interesting people who've got good stories to tell. And in the case of these two women here beside me, we have basically, it's the first time, I'm going through my head as well, have I ever interviewed Olympians before? I don't think so. So I'm really kind of super psyched to have both of you here. We have on the far right, we have Nicky Dryden from Canada. And next to me here, we have Alison from the United States. Perfect. Welcome to Banter at Web Summit. How are you both?
Good, thank you. Thanks for having us up here.
Yeah, loving it.
Okay, this is what I'm going to do in that case is because just for the purpose of the podcast, we're up here with there's three people and two microphones, so it's going to be a bit like the Beastie Boys and pass the microphone. So I'm going to start. The first question is for both of you, and like basically it's about your first moments in the water. At what stage did both of you? What stage did you realize that you were good at swimming and it was something you wanted to pursue?
I was given the option to do a couple sports by my parents, and I tried the couple sports, and the three sports I tried, swimming was the only sport I was good at, so it was a pretty easy choice, and I also enjoyed it, and I pursued it.
Okay.
It's pretty simple.
Okay.
Yeah.
Nikki, was it the same for you?
Mine was sort of the opposite. I played every sport as a young child. And I was very tall, and I grew too fast, so I had Asgeir-Schlatter, which is actually something boys get, where your bones grow faster than your tendons and ligaments. So I had to go to the water because I couldn't be on land anymore. And at age 10, I was terrible. I cheated all the time. As soon as it got shallow, I would touch the bottom. And I think my mom pulled me aside and said, if this is enough is enough, you know, you need to either swim the full lap or we're done. And remember, you can't do land sports anymore. And I thought, oh, no. And so then I stuck it through and then improved very quickly after I committed to it. So, but very different. I was not good at first at all.
But in both your cases, I mean, at what point does it come a situation where you're really good at a sport and you suddenly want to be really competitive at that sport as well? You're entering races, you're almost going into a quasi-professional setup. Like, at what stage did you realize, basically, this is what I want, this is what I want to do? Or was it a case of you were so good at the sport that it's a natural thing to do?
I realized at the age of 10 that I really wanted to pursue it full bore. I was swimming in Berlin, Germany, and training in a pool built by Adolf Hitler, and seized by the military. I was a military kid, and so it was quite in a competitive environment because we travel around Europe to other military bases and compete against each other. So each base had a team, and I was doing well and loving the training and the challenges of it. And I wasn't winning everything, but I was loving trying to.
Yeah, yeah.
So I really devoted myself to it very much at that point.
Because, I mean, this is a question for you now, Nikki. It's like, you know, when you become good at something and when you want to kind of compete in something, you know, there's often the desire to be the best you possibly can. And, like, I'm curious because, I mean, both of you kind of, like, have been very kind of been to the forefront in terms of talking up about doping in sport and talking up about, like, you know, that whole thing about the cheating aspect. At what stage does it enter your mind that, one, the other people in the pool are cheating, and, two, if I need to compete with them, maybe I should cheat, too?
So it's funny because I became passionate about sport and the Olympics watching the 1984 Olympics from Los Angeles, and I was 9, and that's when I knew I wanted to was funny because I wasn't watching the swimming, I was watching the track. And a lot of track and field athletes who were my heroes, you know, eventually that I realized that track and field was quite a dirty sport, but only in hindsight. They still remain my heroes, and I, you know, they were the ones that inspired me to become an Olympian and want that success. I wanted to be on the podium like they were. So for swimming, it never felt, I always, as I became a swimmer and I saw, I thought, okay, track and field is different. That is dirty. And I never really felt, I went to the Olympics in 92 and 96. So 92, I went to the Olympics completely thinking the field was even and that I had a chance at winning gold. It wasn't until 1994 at the World Championships when Chinese women won 12 of 16 events that I was like, wow, this is not clean anymore. And, you know, what happened in East Germany is happening again today in our career. And I never thought I had to do it. That never even crossed my mind, actually. It was just like, okay, they're there. They're cheating. Someone's going to take care of them.
Yeah, that idea as well, like, I mean, that someone's going to take care of it. You know, when you get involved in the sport, there's obviously all the sports management, the sports administration. Do you think in some ways that athletes are quite naive about, like, expecting those people, those officials, what we call in Ireland the blazers, to actually look after things like that?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, especially when you're a younger athlete, which a lot of swimmers are. A lot of swimmers hit their peaks somewhere between 15 and, you know, early 20s. So, yeah, you just put your trust in these organizations that say they're taking care of problems like doping. But as you go along, you start to realize, wait a second, nothing's being done. I haven't, you know, heard anything about rectifications being made for past infractions, and why is that? And you start kind of questioning, and yeah, I don't know. And a lot of people just put their head in the sand as well and just pretend it's all taken care of or just ignore the facts.
I mean, Alison, like, say in the 1996 Olympics, you know, I mean, like, you know, you came second in one race, in the final to the Irish swimmer Michelle Smith. You know, subsequently, you know, she was kind of, there was doping allegations and doping claims around her. Did that, at that time, you know, when you kind of looked around and kind of like, hang on a second, this isn't right, you know, did you find that people were kind of like just not prepared to listen to you or didn't really understand what you were saying?
I had the feeling at that time that what I felt and what I saw and what I knew to be true wasn't important as defined by other people, my sporting federation, the IOC. I felt like it wasn't important because it wasn't being taken care of. By the time I competed in the Olympics, like Nikki, we competed against athletes, Chinese athletes, who were victims of a state-sanctioned doping program. And because of those multiple experiences of competing against those Chinese athletes, by the time I got to the Olympics, I was pretty disappointed in how these matters were handled. But I was concerned. I didn't understand why it was, the difference was so vast between how it was handled and what they said they were going to do.
The Irish sports writer Paul Kim, he's a former professional cyclist. You'll know his name because he's kind of like involved. One of the few people to kind of like point out that Lance Armstrong was involved in doping to begin with. After he was a professional cyclist, he wrote a book called Rough Ride about his experience on the circuit, and he got this brilliant expression called the spit in the soup, where you basically talk about what's going on. You basically go away from the performed narrative. As professional swimmers, as competitive swimmers, as Olympians, did you find there was a kind of, there was also murta among your peers about what's going on? Or, like, I mean, was there discussions in the locker room about, like, hang on a second, X and Y, look, you know, they've developed muscles in places you're not supposed to develop muscles. What is going on here?
Definitely. And, I mean, on the pool deck, there's a lot of talk. And it goes on for, you know, particular athletes that you are suspicious of. And in 96, there were certainly a lot of that around particular swimmers who, you know, came from nowhere. You could just look at the statistics, you could look at the performances and know there's an abnormality there. And so certainly on the pool deck, everyone was talking, and that happened in 94. It actually did result in these swim coaches coming and writing a letter to FINA, which is the World Swimming Federation, and saying, we think these athletes are being systematically doped. FINA, go do something about it. FINA did not do anything about it. They went on two, you know, tests. They went on two visits to China, they unearthed nothing. That was the final results of the FINA investigation on China. But luckily, that system self-destructed a little bit anyway and splintered. But in terms of the talk, yes, amongst the athletes, there's a lot of talk. But I think I've never really said this before, and it's just become more apparent in the types of questions we're getting this week, is that, you know, this could also be a women's issue. You know, although there's doping on the men's side of swimming, right, it's never been quite as extreme, right? East Germany, I think the men were being doped, but it didn't really matter. It was East German women that were successful. China, there might have been Chinese men being doped, but it was the Chinese women that won 12 of 16 events. I think the men won one event at that World Championships. And then when you have some of these isolated individuals who are doping, again, it's usually been on the women's side because doping helps women more, perhaps. Mm. And maybe people aren't taking it seriously because it's, oh, well, that's just part of women's swimming.
But you also think, I mean, this question for both of you, let's start with you, Alison. There's also kind of like getting the public to understand what's going on is often quite hard because the public have a romantic vision about like mean swimmers. Like say, for example, Lance Armstrong, or athletes. Say the Lance Armstrong narrative, dude comes back from cancer and he starts winning loads and loads of kind of like races. And almost like the public perception is they believe the fairy tale over the actual facts.
Yeah, that's unfortunate. When I was running a swim lesson coaching business when Lance was at his peak, I used to mandate that my clients would remove their yellow Livestrong bracelets before they had an appointment with me. And I have no problem with sharing my views and enlightening people to the amount of doping happening at that level of sport. But this summer, I think you probably agree, Nikki, but I didn't have to do that at all. Everybody I talked to was disgusted, and a lot of people didn't watch the Olympics because of it. And these aren't sports fans. These are just people who watch the Olympics every time the Olympics airs every 4 years, the Summer Olympics or the Winter Olympics as well. But, you know, these aren't people that know a lot about sport, but they still are just, ugh, this is not in line with what I had in mind when I, you know, thought about the Olympics, and I think about the Olympic spirit and, you know, striving for excellence and performance in a way that inspires other people. And nobody's inspired by drug use. And it's quite frightening as well. A lot of people don't understand that there's a lot of health risks when people use these drugs.
Yeah.
For me, the interesting thing is that, you know, in the sporting community and on the pool deck and in other sports, we've always sort of known that there's doping. The International Olympic Committee has done an excellent job of covering it up, sometimes in what I believe are very illicit means of doing that. And there's certainly rumors that go back to the 80s of positive tests being covered up. But I think the prevalence of social media and alternative forms of information have really allowed the general public to understand the depth of the doping problem in sport. And previously, you have, it's so complicated when you're looking at the major media who are also the sponsors of the Olympics. So NBC News is totally complicit in all the problems that are engaged in sport because NBC News does not exist when it comes to covering the Olympics. They have their sports division, and then the news department doesn't seem to cover anything negative around there because they've spent so much money on that entertainment property. But, you know, when you have alternative news sites like Inside the Games, which is this fantastic website, that covers the Olympic Games, all of a sudden, the debacle in Russia and all of that, you know, New York Times is picking up those articles for the first time. And those stories have all been out there over this whole time, but the mainstream media never picked them up. And finally, that happened this summer, and that's why you have people who are not sports fans learning about the extent of the doping problem.
Yeah. And, like, I mean, the extent of the doping problems today, do you think it's as bad as it was back in your kind of heyday in the 1990s? I mean, I'm curious about this. I'm curious about, like, I mean, the level of which it's at. Or have basically dopers become more expert in covering things up a little?
Well, the biggest problem, and Nikki will definitely talk about this as well, is the corruption. And I have a big problem with the way the standards and anti-doping protocols are not upheld uniformly. They're all outlines, but the procedures are not followed through uniformly. Sometimes they are, sometimes they aren't. And we saw evidence of this summer where the water report showed that only 50% of athletes were tested that were planned to be tested. And that's a big problem. So in some ways, it seems like it's worse. You know, I always feel like I just got really unlucky in my career. You know, I just happened to be at the top of my game at a time when China happened to peak their state sanction. Their athletes participating in the state sanction doping program. And then I just happened to be the 96 games in that time frame when Michelle Smith was competing. Is a matter of timing. I mean, timing worked in my favor in some ways, but as far as having a clean race, I didn't have a ton of those on a world stage.
Talk a little bit, Nikki, then about the enforcement level. You know, there's something you talked about the other day when you were talking at the sports stage here at Web Summit. You talked about, like, I mean, a police force, you know, a way of kind of like me doing that and getting it enforced and having an independent police force as well.
Yeah, so when WADA was formed, that's the World Anti-Doping Association, when that was formed about 10 years ago, there was a need to some extent that the International Olympic Committee be involved because we needed one entity in order to back WADA to get the buy-in of governments around the world. And as much as I dislike the IOC, they played that role initially. But unfortunately, they've stayed involved, and therefore it's led to discredit the organization to some extent. You know, the head of WADA is also a member of the IOC, that's the International Olympic Committee. And so what's happened is, and then the arbitration system, which is the Court of Arbitration of Sport that would resolve issues around WADA and doping violations, that system, an IOC vice president appoints all the arbitrators for the CAS. So you have a completely corrupt system where everyone's involved in everything. Nothing is independent. And the International Olympic Committee is a secret society. You know, some of the people on the IOC are really bad people, convicted felons, liars, plagiarists of their PhD. Some of them are completely ignorant of sport. You know, they're royals. They have no, you know, relationship to either a sport or any kind of sports administration. So you have this really eclectic group of people who are running world sport. How they're elected, secret. They're all basically elected for life for the most part. There's no term limits. And then on top of that, then you have them all with their fingers in everything. You know, they're the head of their National Olympic Committee. They're the head of their the doping associations. And so the corruption just trickles all the way down. So what we're looking for is, and when WADA was developed, it was really meant to just harmonize anti-doping around the world. And they've done a very good job of that, bringing uniformity across the rules of the game so that someone who is a swimmer in Canada who tests positive is treated the same way as a tennis player in Russia. That's supposed to be the way it works. But unfortunately, the enforcement piece of WADA was left to the countries. So that means you have a situation like happened this summer where RUSADA, which was the Russian Anti-Doping Association, which is empowered to implement anti-doping testing, etc., in Russia, were the same entity that was doping Russian athletes and testing them through the WADA-accredited labs. So what we need is, WADA first needs to be independent of the Olympic Committee. We have to figure out, though, of course, how to fund it. That's a fundamental issue we have is funding. And then once they are separate from the international sports community and are really independent, then we can empower them to be that sort of police force.
I mean, like, you know, as you're talking about the Russian situation, I'm just kind of going like, on one hand, they're doping, and on the other hand, they're testing for doping. It just strikes me as a non-athlete as completely and utterly, like, fucked up. It really does. It messed up. But I'm curious as well, like, I mean, Alison, this is a question from you, and it's something that I can't remember if you or Nikki touched on this the other day, which is the psychological effects of this, the negative effects of being in a race where you suspect someone else or know someone else is doping. That must be really hard for young athletes to kind of, like, deal with. And it also must be a situation where if they're in a pool with people they know are dirty, they're thinking, well, they've got an unfair advantage. Do I need to have that unfair advantage too?
Well, I'm sure people think that way. I can only speak really from my experience. Competing multiple times against athletes who were doping left a mark. I take responsibility for my actions, but I also, you know, was a young person who didn't know how to deal with that situation. I felt completely powerless. And unfortunately, after the Olympics completed, for the next 15 years, I didn't try for anything. I didn't put effort towards anything meaningful in my life. I suffered a lot of repercussions on multiple levels, psychological being one of them. I had my college scholarship removed because I won the silver medal, not the gold. I had turned down so much money along the way. And not only was I competing in a completely unjust, unfair system and not being protected by anybody, I had then to go out and start my life anew, feeling like I gained nothing of substance from my swimming career. And that's not how an Olympian should feel. And I had, there are a lot of things that I gained from that experience, obviously. But when you are, I gained so many things, but I lost so much. I lost so much more. And that's unfortunate. And watching the Summer's Games, I really feel compelled to make sure that nobody else has to go through that. Somebody should do something to protect these athletes that are competing fairly and cleanly. Somebody should be, like we are, raising awareness about the corruption and about how the system really works and how it's laid out so that hopefully something will change. And somebody should be speaking up on behalf of those victims of state-sanctioned doping programs, which, I mean, that's an unfortunate situation as well. I mean, it's a dangerous endeavor to be a part of in many ways, psychological, emotional, physical. But, yeah, from my experience, I experienced a lot of ramifications, and I foot the bill for everything. And it's unfortunate. And with a little bit of policing, with maybe a lot of policing, with a change in the setup of how doping is monitored, I really think that there can be some change, positive change soon.
Both of you have kind of referenced, you know, you both use the same word, which is like victims of state-sanctioned doping programs. Have you talked to these people? What is their experience? Or are they prepared to talk?
When I was in law school, I wrote an article. It was my first sort of piece of human rights activism and lawyering. And I wrote about state-sponsored doping in China as a human rights violation. And I sort of, you know, I bumbled through it because I was a law student. I didn't quite know how to articulate myself. But one of the things I advocated for was existing international human rights organizations to be involved because sports couldn't do it themselves. And one of my things that I was looking for at the time was trying to find a Chinese athlete, because all the stories I had heard, I read extensively about East Germany, I'd read extensively about China, was, you know, the human cost of those athletes, because they were guinea pigs, basically. The B team, so there was the Chinese national swim team is divided into two. There was an A team and a B team, and the B team were the ones that got, were the guinea pigs. They were often the ones that got caught doping because they were testing out different things on them. And it's the exact same thing that happened in East Germany. You talk about that, you hear the same stories. And because it was the East German coaches that went to China and took all these strategies with them. And the same even in, and it's continued, right? So in Russia, some of the whistleblowers, there's a woman, and I can't remember now what sport. She was a track and field athlete, I think a field athlete. She was one of the first people to try to report some of this systematic doping back to WADA. The WADA then handed that information back to the Russian Olympic Committee. She's now, I think the New York Times had one sentence in their piece saying, you know, we tried to find her, but we couldn't. That terrifies me. You know, is she even alive? I have no idea. Are those Chinese athletes who are completely expendable? There were 15-year-old girls who were taken away from their families, systematically doped in the system, tested positive, and were completely ostracized from their society. I mean, what if they actually loved swimming? Now they can't swim anymore. They're sent back to their village or their home, wherever they're from, and completely they were perceived as the cheaters, when yet they were just expendable too, so that the other athlete could then use whatever drug and doping. So I think there's a language barrier, there's a cultural barrier. I mean, anyone who has any connection in China, in Russia, I would love, you know, it would be amazing if they could reach out to some of these athletes. And I think there are finally, you're hearing some, there's a woman in China who was an administrator, and she's now in hiding. She's sort of like under watch, and her life is at risk because she spoke out saying she didn't want to be part of a doping system. I just learned about her the other day, and I'm like, oh, I've got to see if I can find her. But, I mean, I don't speak Chinese. I don't speak Russian. So I think there are, you know, limitations to that. But I think that's what we should be doing. The international community should be reaching out to those young people who were doped as part of any kind of international system. What they've done in East Germany and now in Germany is fantastic. They've, you know, all of the victims of state-sponsored doping have received financial assistance, recognition of what happened to them. And it's really incredible what the German government has done. That won't happen in China and Russia, but let's see how we can reach out and find them, because it's very scary to think what's happened to some of those young and mostly young girls.
Yeah, I want to pick up on that, because you, with Alison, because you talked about it earlier on, Nikki, you talked about the fact that, like, it was mostly women, you know, it was mostly women who were taken. I was just thinking, as Nikki was talking there, Alison, that, you know, this idea that women were always, like, expandable, usable, it's almost like a form of kind of slavery in some ways, you know, and I'm just kind of, from your experience as Olympians and people who've competed at meetings, you know, were they behaving in a way that kind of like showed that, like, okay, actually, there's something quite serious going on here? And did it also strike you that the people who, the coaches and all those people, were completely complicit in things as well?
So you're asking me if the coaches were complicit?
Yeah, yeah.
And if the athletes did they know?
Yeah, did they kind of appear? I suppose, did the athletes appear as if, like, okay, this, we had no other choice. They were forced to do this.
Well, most of them, I mean, the girls from China, they didn't know they were being doped. They had been doped from such a young age that they didn't have the chance to know that, oh, these changes in my body might not be normal. They were so young, they didn't know. They didn't know that their bodies, what their bodies were supposed to be doing at that time. So they didn't know they were being doped. They fully on believed that they were just being given, you know, what did they say, mushrooms? Chinese mushrooms or something, Chinese medicine of some sort. I mean, I was in multiple press conferences, and these poor girls, you know, I didn't feel too sorry for them at the time because I was frustrated. But I also, it left a mark, because they really thought that they were competing fairly. And I really wonder what it was like for them when they found out they were being doped, when they found out they had been cheating that whole time, because they did find out. And I can't imagine that. I mean, I know multiple athletes who dropped out of their own sports, two cyclists specifically, who competed in Europe, and they found out they were being doped as young people, and they refused to dope any longer. And, of course, they couldn't compete for much longer, given the nature of cycling. But those poor girls, they had no idea. And I also think about, you know, the lifelong effects of those drugs. And I remember doing a report in sixth grade on doping and sports. And, you know, the cover I drew with colored pencil pictures of pills and syringes. And then I researched everything I could find at the time about this, because I had been living in Germany. And I'd been exposed to a little bit as a child of what happens, you know, that people actually do cheat with drugs. I wonder what they think now. Now, I watched Shirley Babbitt, the Making Waves, the movie about Shirley Babishoff, and I was interested to see that most of those athletes weren't willing to acknowledge. They knew they had been doped, but none of them were talking about it very openly, and that was interesting to me, because I think if it was me, I wouldn't feel at peace in myself unless I apologized. And I would do it publicly, and I wouldn't do it in the way Lance did. You know, he was forced to. And you know, I'm not in that situation, so it's really hard to say, but I know myself. And that's the other thing I think about. How do these people live with themselves, the ones that aren't victims of state-sanctioned programs? And that really bothers me, because that's no way to live. And it's certainly not the kind of world I want to live in. It's not the people I want in my world. They don't contribute positively to the world by lying to themselves about the actions they took that completely lacked in integrity.
Last couple of questions. I really appreciate you giving me the time as well to talk about this. You know, last couple of questions. First of all, like, I mean, like, Nikki, you know, tell me a little bit about this petition. Like, you talked earlier on, just very quickly in passing, about raising awareness. Is the petition a part of this, and what do you hope to achieve?
Yeah. So there's quite a bit of things happening in the world of anti-doping right now, and as a result of what happened in Russia. So you finally have the International Olympic Committee going, oh my goodness, like, we'd really dropped the ball on this. You know, they were sweating. They were sweating this summer in a way I've never seen them sweat before. You know, there's quite a few high-level conferences. The IOC had one with just themselves recently. There's one at WADA coming up at the end of November. So I think there is a sense of timing here. You know, we want to get the international athletic community and the general public to support the petition so that we can go and say, look, you know, there are people who are interested in these kind of changes. And, you know, what we're advocating for, some people have written about it, and I think that, you know, one of the things that in particular, so we've talked about, you know, enforcement of the code and empowering an independent agency to do that. I'll let Allison talk about the other two because I think that, well, I'll mention the second one because it's sort of putting in place something to revisit what's happened prior to 2000 in terms of people who, because, you know, now with technology, we're at a tech conference, we are able to save some of these samples, right? So people's samples are frozen for, I think, up to 8 years. I'm not sure if they're going back farther. And what you're seeing was quite extraordinary, where right before every Olympics, they're retesting the sample from before, and people are being stripped of their medals. It's crazy. Weightlifting, I think every 5 minutes, there's a new gold medalist in the weightlifting category for the 04 and 08 and even 2012 Olympics. But there's, for people before 2000, there doesn't seem to be any process for revisiting and righting those wrongs. And I think we would like to see something set up. And it might, those tests, you know, there's a real movement now that you don't have to test positive with a urine sample for a drug that's in the code. You can have an anti-doping violation through a non-analytical positive and circumstantial-based evidence. So there's got to be a way that pre-2000, even without the samples, we can, as investigators, put together a puzzle and something that says, okay, at this time, this person, using all this circumstantial evidence, based on statistics, based on data, based on, other information that we have, based on future positive tests or anti-doping violations, that we can put together a thing that says, yes, on this day at the 96 Olympics, this person, you know, was violating anti-doping procedures. Let's go back and revisit who should have got those medals. Yeah. And I think that that's something that we would like to see some sort of system put in place in how we gather that information and what is the process for determining who is the rightful gold medalist and silver medalist and bronze medalist.
Yeah, so we have 3 points. One, enforce uniformly the anti-doping standards and procedures as outlined in the WADA code. And like I said earlier, I have a big problem with this because that should be pretty, should be in place, should already be happening. Like, let's just enforce what you actually say is the code. Number two, we want a protocol established for reviewing suspected instances of doping prior to Sydney 2000. And number three, we want to enact a policing system to monitor anti-doping efforts and protocols as prescribed by the WADA code. There needs to be some sort of policing system, so that something like what happened in Russia doesn't happen again. As Nikki already described, you can't ask the people that are doping their athletes to enforce the rules. It doesn't make any sense. Yeah, totally. So there needs to be something independent. And, yeah, funding is going to be a challenge, but some way there needs to be something. Last I checked, there's quite a bit of money involved in the Olympics, so maybe they can funnel a little bit of that towards actually maintaining the integrity of the games.
Is there anything ordinary sports fans who are listening to you on this podcast can actually do right now?
Well, they can sign our petition. They can find it at allisonwagner.com, AllisonWagner.com. I'm trying to build momentum in whatever ways we can come up with. If anybody has any interest who's listening and supporting our efforts, just reach out to me and...
I don't know how to find me. Tweet me, I guess. I think that the other thing that an average sports fan can do is, like, start asking questions of their whatever their sports organization that they're committed to. So if it's your national sports organization, you know, asking Swimming Canada, like, what are you guys doing? What is your opinion on this? And when you get to those international meetings with FINA, what are you saying? What is the Canadian Swimming Federation saying? You know, or what is your National Olympic Committee doing? You know, and asking questions. Well, how do you spend your money? You know, a lot of this is funded by the governments around the world. The U.S. is a little different, but most athletes at the Olympic level are funded by their governments. That's taxpayer dollars in all of these countries. The IOC says that they give money to sport. Well, let's ask them to show us their financials, because it's all secret. And so I think as citizens and taxpayers, we need to be asking our local committee, organizing committees, Olympic committees and sports federations, you know, when you go to these meetings, what are the notes from the meetings? Did you talk about this? Because this is our dollars that are going towards this. So I think people do have a vested interest in it. If you want to see clean sport at the Olympics and cheer for your athletes, you know, there's a lot of things that you could do to find out, you know, how are our athletes getting there, and stop letting sport act like they're separate from society. Don't give them autonomy, because they have totally abused it.
And also, just let's keep talking about it. I mean, now that everybody has a platform through their preferred social media platform, express your displeasure. Talk about it with your friends. Keep the awareness up. You know, I think that can be something, and it could lead to something that we haven't foreseen.
Awesome, Wagner, Nikki Trident, thank you so much for coming along to Banter today. Really appreciate it. Thanks so much for your time. Thank you, Urge.
Many thanks to Alison and Nikki for joining us at Banter. Thanks to Dara, Eleanor, Catherine, James, Kira and Richard at Web Summit. And obrigado to local crew, Josh, Caesar and Ricardo, for all their help with Banter in Lisbon. This podcast was produced by Banter series producer Tanya White. Be sure to check out the other podcasts from Banter at Web Summit, and check thisisbanter.com for news what we're up to. Thanks very much for listening, and we'll talk to you again real soon.